It is Tuesday, September 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump joins other Americans as the United States pays tribute to those killed 17 years ago in terror attacks in New York, Virginia, and Pennsylvania.
Today, all of America wraps up and joins together. We close our arms to help you shoulder your pain.
More than a million people are ordered to evacuate as Hurricane Florence approaches the U.S. East Coast, and we look at efforts to end human trafficking and modern-day slavery. It's all ahead. The United States Tuesday marked the 17th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks that killed almost 3,000 people in New York, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. In New York, hundreds of survivors and family members of those killed gathered at Ground Zero, where the twin towers of the World Trade Center stood before two hijacked commercial flights brought them down. The names of the victims were read out loud during a solemn ceremony, and bagpipes sounded a tribute. In Shanksville, Pennsylvania, near where United Airlines Flight 93 crashed after 40 passengers and crew members retook control of the plane from Al-Qaeda-affiliated hijackers, mourners gathered to remember. President Donald Trump spoke at the Shanksville ceremony.
We're here to pay solemn tribute to the 40 passengers and crew members on Flight 93 who rose up, defied the enemy, took control of their destiny, and changed the course of history. Today we mourn their loss, we share their story, and we commemorate their incredible valor.
Trump said the entire nation stands with the family members of those who perished.
Today, all of America wraps up and joins together. We close our arms to help you shoulder your pain and to carry your great, great sorrow. Your tears are not shed alone, for they are shared grief with an entire nation. We grieve together for every mother and father, sister and brother, son and daughter, who was stolen from us at the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and here in this Pennsylvania field. We honor their sacrifice by pledging to never flinch in the face of evil and to do whatever it takes to keep America safe.
A memorial service also took place at the Pentagon, where VOA correspondent Carla Babb now joins us. Carla, Vice President Mike Pence joined Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis for the proceedings. What did they say?
Yes, he did. They were talking about the individuals killed and how the entire world and everybody in the Pentagon is part of that family and will never forget those killed, 184 killed here at the Pentagon. The youngest, Dana Faulkenberg, was just 3 years old. Vice President Pence pointed her out by name, and we think about that. She would be 20 years old today had she not been a part of this horrible terrorist attack. Secretary Mattis saying this attack gave the United States military a purpose that this would never happen again.
You know, this must be such an emotional time at the Pentagon. I mean, 125 people were killed there and 64 people on American Airlines Flight 77. Now, there is, of course, a permanent memorial to them.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Paul Selva, pointed out that the majority of people who are serving in the military joined after and because of September 11th, 2001. Several of the reporters here were there during 9/11. I was speaking to one, Jamie McIntyre, who said that he could feel that day the world changing. He could feel that nothing else would be the same. And, you know, they mentioned the purpose, and Secretary Mattis actually led a Marine task force when he was Marine to Afghanistan shortly after 9/11. He stopped by just a few minutes before I spoke to you, and he was talking about how Afghanistan is changing. And I asked him, I said, Mr. Secretary, how is it changing? Because al-Qaeda is still fighting. And there are people who would say that reconciliation with the Taliban would not be a victory. It would be accepting defeat. And he said, well, yeah, there were several conditions to negotiate and to reconcile with the Taliban. Stop killing, break with al-Qaeda, the terrorist group in charge of these attacks. And I said, well, sir, they haven't done that yet. And he goes, well, there are non-quantifiables there. They cannot use religious rhetoric anymore to justify the killing of innocents. People are pushing back. People are wanting ceasefires in that country. So he pointed out those factors, and he said, Carla, the biggest point is that they are not able to attack us anymore. Al-Qaeda terrorists cannot attack us and have not been able to attack us on American soil since that horrible day on September 11th, 2001.
All right. Thanks very much, Carla. That is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A million people rally in Barcelona for Catalonian independence. Suicide bombings kill 32 people in eastern Afghanistan. A cholera emergency is declared in the capital of Zimbabwe. And at least 40 people are killed in a bus crash in India. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Well, more than a million people have been ordered to evacuate parts of the southeastern U.S. coast as a powerful hurricane barrels toward the shore. Mandatory evacuation orders were given to parts of the states of South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia as forecasters and officials urge people to prepare for devastating winds and heavy rains from Hurricane Florence. The National Hurricane Center says it expects the storm to make landfall late Thursday into Friday as an extremely dangerous major hurricane. Hurricane specialist David Zelizer is with the National Hurricane Center. He tells VOA about Florence's expected progression.
Florence has been rapidly intensifying over the past 24 hours or so, and the size of the storm is also increasing. So the maximum sustained winds, as measured recently by NOAA Hurricane Hunter aircraft, are about 140 miles per hour with higher gusts, and the storm is moving west-northwest at about 13 miles per hour. We expect that it's going to gradually increase in forward speed as it starts to move closer to the Carolinas and the mid-Atlantic U.S. coast over the next few days. The important thing here is it's at this point we expect Florence to remain a major hurricane as it approaches the U.S. coast. It's important not to get too hung up on the details of exactly how strong it will be. Storms of this intensity sometimes can fluctuate over short periods of time up or down, but regardless of the exact intensity, we expect that Florence is going to be a very dangerous major hurricane when it makes landfall in the U.S. There's also going to be threats of storm surge flooding along the coast where it makes landfall, and then there's also an increasing threat of very heavy rain due to the fact that Florence is expected to slow down after it makes landfall. And because of that, you're going to have several days of very heavy rains, and especially in some of the mountainous areas of the Carolinas, this could result in some life-threatening freshwater flooding just from the heavy rain.
Hurricane specialist David Zelizer with the National Hurricane Center. The Trump administration has taken a hard line against the Hague-based International Criminal Court, with White House National Security Advisor John Bolton describing it as ineffective, unaccountable, and dangerous, with the aim of constraining U.S. policymakers. Bolton said the ICC has requested authorization to investigate allegations of war crimes committed by U.S. personnel in Afghanistan for alleged rights abuses, even though the U.S. is not party to the Rome Statute giving it authority. He said the U.S. will not cooperate with the ICC for its flagrant violation of America's national sovereignty. Bolton said the ICC may also investigate Israeli construction of housing projects in the West Bank at the request of the Palestinians. He announced the closure of the Palestine Liberation Organization office in Washington in response.
As President Reagan recognized in this context, the executive has the right to decide the kind of foreign relations, if any, the United States will maintain. And the Trump administration will not keep the office open when the Palestinians refuse to take steps to start direct and meaningful negotiations with Israel. The United States supports a direct and robust peace process, and we will not allow the ICC or any other organization to constrain Israel's right to self-defense.
Israel welcomed the move, but Palestinian diplomat Saeb Erekat called it an affirmation of the Trump administration's policy to collectively punish the Palestinian people. The announcement followed cuts or redirection of U.S. funding to agencies providing employment, health care, and education to the Palestinians. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, on one hand, he was surprised the administration took this decision so quickly.
I'm not surprised because the American strategy has been to continue to escalate the cost of not cooperating with the U.S. policy and strategy, and to hope that this kind of escalation would lead to some degree of compromise and cooperation on the part of Palestinian authorities. Now, this doesn't seem to have happened so far. The question now really is, what will happen if this particular step does not lead to the desired effects of bringing the Palestinian Authority around, which it is not likely to do given the circumstances? Therefore, the way I see it at this moment is two things. One, this is likely to increase the tension in the Middle East at large. Number of countries which have been supportive of Palestinian Authority and Palestinian independence are likely to basically argue that they told you so. They're going to move forward and be more supportive of the Palestinian authorities. At the same time, countries which could be viewed as amenable to the U.S. policy, like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, may find it increasingly difficult to support it.
The head of the PLO delegation to the U.S. accused the Trump administration of dismantling decades of U.S. vision and engagement in Palestine, quote, Ambassador Hussam Zumlot, weaponizing humanitarian and developmental aid as political blackmail does not work.
No, it doesn't work. It really doesn't work. Because, you see, for it to work, what you have to do is to make sure that there is no alternative means of at least partially making up for the losses to one of the parties. If that party can make up those losses, number one, or at least partially make up those losses, and then use this policy initiative as a vehicle to seek support from elsewhere, then it ends up generating greater degree of instability in the region. It's not useful for anyone. It doesn't serve the U.S. interest or the cause for peace in the region. But my concern is the following. If you start on a policy with the expectation of a certain objective or a target, and you find over time that it isn't working, you don't escalate it. You find an alternative way of achieving your objective. That doesn't seem to have been done because the assumption here is that we have only one instrument and we're going to use it and keep escalating it. That's a wrong way of looking at things.
The announcement of the closure of the PLO office in Washington came just 3 days before the 25th anniversary of the Oslo Accords, a set of agreements between Israel and the Palestinians aimed at ending their conflict and providing the basis for a future Palestinian state. That process, said Zubair Iqbal, is over and will need to be replaced by a new formula, although he added that is presently a remote prospect. The United Nations warns a full-scale war in the northwestern Syrian province of Idlib could become this century's worst humanitarian disaster, as countless thousands of the nearly 3 million civilians trapped in this enclave would be killed. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN reports an upsurge in aerial and ground-based bombardment by Syrian and Russian forces over the past week has killed scores of civilians and displaced more than 30,000 women, children, and men within the region. Half of Idlib's nearly 3 million population is displaced from other areas in Syria. All are trapped in Idlib because there is nowhere else where they can go. A spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says conversations with Syrian officials indicate the government is intent on retaking this last rebel-held enclave and will push for a military solution. He calls this a very scary prospect.
We are saying that this has the potential to be the worst crisis, humanitarian crisis in the 21st century, because that is frankly what it looks like if it goes ahead with a full-scale military operation. A horrible situation. It's a race against time. It's a race against where we have to try to plan for the worst possible scenario while we are trying the best we can to avoid that scenario.
Lajerke says aid agencies are stocking up on food, medicines, and other essential relief in preparation for a military onslaught on Idlib. To add to the suffering of the people, he notes four hospitals in the area have been struck in less than a week, limiting the availability of medical care at a time when it will be especially needed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. When the United Kingdom enacted its 2015 Modern Slavery Act, Prime Minister Theresa May called it the great human rights issue of our time. Following the lead of the UK, Australia's coalition government has been active on working to end human trafficking and modern-day slavery, including efforts to directly engage big business. It recently put forth legislation requiring larger Australian companies to disclose any knowledge of human trafficking, forced labor, and related practices among their suppliers and subcontractors, and the steps taken to address this. Internationally, Western firms are facing similar calls, but according to experts, it doesn't always translate to consumer conduct that reflects these values or expectations. Jolyon Ford, professor of law at Australia National University, spoke with International Edition's Laurie London. She said to him that it sounds from his writings that modern-day slavery is alive and well, and consumers don't often realize that they're unknowingly contributing to it.
Everyone understands slavery as a sort of historical phenomenon, and you know, in terms of the human rights movement and human rights discourse that we know today, that slavery was the first big international human rights issue. There's less awareness today that there are still people, you know, in this time and hour of the 21st century, there's still people who are not free to leave where they work or are not compensated for their work or in other forms, to all intents and purposes, slaves or living in slave-like conditions. And some of those people are trafficked into forced labor, and some of them are in sort of much longer-term bonded labor situations, especially in parts of South Asia. And what I suppose the issues that the Australian government is working on and others in the EU and the UK is, what does this mean in terms of goods and services that find their way into global supply chains and so into kind of first world markets where the conditions under which some of those things were made amount in effect to slavery.
What about consumers? Is there anything they can try to do or not do?
I think consumers are the missing piece of this puzzle. So here in Australia, the EU, in the UK, in California, has a Supply Chains Transparency Act piece of legislation requiring company reporting on child labor and forced labor, retail and manufacturing sectors. So there are parts of the world where there are legal instruments and legal regimes that deal with this, but how useful are they really if consumers themselves don't know about these issues, or even if they know about them, they don't really act on them in the way in which they choose their or adapt their purchasing behaviors. And certainly in Australia, the whole debate on modern slavery has been led, it's actually been led by big business, by one particular very wealthy businessman who has championed this issue. So it's actually been government and big business that has been leading the drive for more action on slavery in supply chains, and it's consumers who are sort of only slowly coming to the picture, and consumer awareness is actually quite low.
Is it a big problem in Australia particularly?
It's not a problem particularly in Australia, but Australia's taking sort of quite proactive steps about the prospect that Australian companies' supply chain, so supplying into the Australian consumer market, might be tainted in some way, the human labor conditions under which things are made in other parts of the world. So in Southeast Asia, in North Asia and China, and Vietnam and Cambodia and elsewhere. So to give an example from Australia that's prompted some attention, a well-known surf brand procured its winter range 2016, it thought from China, from a Chinese contractor, but the Chinese contractor had subcontracted to North Korean factories where the workers are not compensated for what they do. So in effect, they're forced labor. Mm. So it's those sorts of situations which makes Australia, as you know, in the sort of regulatory state of Australia, say, well, what is our responsibility, authority or opportunity to try and regulate in some way the ways in which forced labor and human trafficking and modern slavery find their way into supply chains. So Australia's adapting a model from 2015 that the UK came up with, which forces larger companies doing business in the UK and in future in Australia to report annually on what steps they are taking in their supply chain to address these risks.
How are they coming to be in these situations? How is this happening?
So in India, there are generations of bonded labor, some of the highly stratified classes in that society. But there are all sorts of ways in which people might come into a forced labor situation. The most familiar ones are the ones that we see here onshore in Australia itself, relate to the sex industry. So people who are brought in under certain pretenses that they will work in hospitality or entertainment industry, but then find themselves working in effect in the sex industry and are not free to leave. Their documents are taken away. In those sorts of situations, especially where there's a threat of violence, you can see this as working in effect in a slavery-like conditions. But across our whole region in Southeast and South Asia, there are all sorts of situations where people are trafficked. In other words, they are moved as commodities into factories, into extractive processes on farms or in the fishing industry, and are forced to work and are not free to leave. So, for example, refugees from Burma, Myanmar, crossing the border into Thailand, are offered a job on a fishing boat. But what they don't realize is that once they're on that vessel, they can't leave. Their passports and documents are taken away, and they spend 3, 5, who knows how many years, unable to leave that work. And their option is to stay working on the boat or be pushed into the sea, pretty much, if you want to put it as starkly as that. What does that mean for Australian companies that buy tuna fish from the Gulf of Thailand, where it's possible, not inevitable, but it's possible that some of that was caught on boats that use effectively modern slaves?
Jolyon Ford, professor of law at Australia National University. He spoke with International Edition's Lori London. And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Next up, a conversation with Jeff Pegues, author of the new book, Kompromat, How Russia Undermined American Democracy. Pegues says despite recent indictments of Russian persons and entities, Vladimir Putin's operatives continue to try to sabotage U.S. democracy as we head into midterm elections. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.